This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of our producers heard that a lot of elected officials and at least one presidential hopeful, Bill Clinton, were influenced by a new book called Reinventing Government. Well, we got the book and invited on one of the authors, David Osborne. You'll probably agree with the premise of this book, that our local and federal governments are in deep trouble. They are overrun by bureaucracies and doing an inadequate job of providing services. Our schools are bad, our prisons overcrowded, our healthcare system is out of control, and many of our cities are virtually bankrupt. So, what are the author's solutions? They say we need an American perestroika that will get rid of dinosaur bureaucracies and develop flexible, responsive, humane systems. The new model they propose is entrepreneurial government. Anyone who's managed a budget will probably relate to this example of how Visalia, California, did away with a layer of bureaucracy.
Visalia is a city of about 60,000 in California, and my co-author, Ted Gabler, was city manager there for about 8 years. And after Proposition 13, which took away a quarter of their revenues overnight, they adopted a different budget system. The traditional line-item budget systems waste an enormous amount of money. They encourage every manager to waste money, because if you don't spend every penny of every line item by the end of the fiscal year, you lose it and you get less next year.
So that's right. It's like you're punished for, for being efficient.
You're punished for saving money. And so only a fool doesn't spend every penny of every line item, whether you need to or not. And a lot of these line items may have made sense 10 years ago, but you don't really need to spend all that money anymore. You might need it somewhere else, but it's very hard to move it. So we're encouraging managers to waste money. A city in California called Fairfield invented a new system, and Ted Gabler and his city council of Visalia adopted it 6 months later. Basically, they said, we're going to do away with line items. Every agency gets one budget number for the year. They get to manage it how they want. And if they don't spend it all, they get to roll the money over for next year. And, you know, if they want to use it for bonuses, fine. If they want to use it for computers, fine. It's their money to manage. Suddenly, you've got all the managers thinking about saving money because they all have new things they want to do. So in Visalia, the Parks and Recreation Department over a few years had saved up about $60,000. And the school district had built a school but couldn't afford a swimming pool. So for a number of years at this high school, there was a big hole but no swimming pool. And then somebody called a third-level Parks and Recreation guy in Visalia and said, listen, this is in 1984. The Olympic training pool is going on sale. It was August. It's this very nice aluminum pool that can be taken apart, moved, installed for half of what you'd pay for a new one. Well, the Parks and Rec guy went to the assistant city manager. I think Ted was out of town, but he went to the assistant and he told him about it. He said, sounds like a good idea. Then the Parks and Rec, so they went to the school board, and the school board was going to have to announce a meeting, hold a meeting. Would have taken at least 3 weeks to get permission to spend this money. And then the Parks and Rec fellow gets a call and says, two colleges want this pool, and they're racing each other to get the check together. There was a $60,000 non-refundable deposit required. And somebody was going to bring that check in on a Monday, and this was Thursday. So the Parks and Rec guy writes a check for $60,000, gets in his car, and on Friday drives to Los Angeles and delivers it, and Visalia got the pool. Now, the reason he could do that was because they had the money saved up because of their budget system, because the city understood. The city had gone through a lot of strategic planning, and the assistant city manager understood that the city council and the manager and the school district all wanted this new pool. They knew they could find ways to finance it. They ended up raising half the money from the community with a fundraising drive. But it's just an example of the flexibility you need in today's world. I mean, they had to make a decision today, and their budget system allowed them the capacity to do that, which is very rare in government.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening now who manage budgets are really excited at this idea, you know, of having flexibility and independence and, you know, all the things that your story sums up. You know, on the other hand, there are reasons why you're supposed to go through channels before writing out a big check like that. Does it bother you that those checks and balances wouldn't exist in the kind of freer system that you're describing?
Well, all the checks and balances, and they were put in there the last time we reinvented government, which was the Progressive Era. And what we were trying to do at that point was control the boss tweeds of the world. We were trying to control the political machines that were robbing the public blind. And we put an enormous amount of checks and balances in and made it very hard to steal the public's money. At the same time, we made it very hard to manage the public's money. What we're talking about, what you see when you look at entrepreneurial public organizations, is that they've shifted the control from the inputs. I mean, a line item is an input. It's a control over how much you can spend. It says nothing about the outcome, the results. They shift the control from the inputs over to the outcomes by measuring the performance of each organization. Say you're running a parks and recreation department. Well, they would measure your efficiency. They would survey your customers and see how satisfied they are. They might measure the cleanliness of your parks, litter. There's lots of things you can measure to decide whether a parks and recreation department is doing a good job. If you're doing that and you have real information about results, then you can afford to let up on the line items, on the inputs, on the rules and the regulations, because you've got some quality control. And that's what entrepreneurial organizations do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Osborne, co-author of the book Reinventing Government. Your book is subtitled How the Entrepreneurial Spirit is Transforming the Public Sector. Now, but when you say entrepreneurial spirit, you're not talking about running the government like a business.
No, the word entrepreneurial doesn't mean just business-like. It's a very interesting word. It was really developed by a French economist 200 years ago. What he said was that an entrepreneur is someone who brings resources together in new ways to add value and heighten productivity. Now, that applies whether you're running a nonprofit organization or a for-profit organization or a government. And we thought that we were looking for a word that kind of contrasted with the word bureaucratic. I mean, everybody understands that the big problem with government is these hopeless bureaucracies. What's the opposite of that in people's minds? Well, it's entrepreneurial organizations. I mean, it kind of connotes an organization that's flexible and innovative and creative and able to change rapidly. And that's the kind of institution we need in government today. So we chose the word, knowing that it would be provocative and hoping that it would get people to think a little differently.
Well, in what sense, though, should the government not be run like a business? Government and business are two really different animals.
Exactly. And in the introduction, we wanted to make sure people didn't assume we were saying run government like a business. So there's a section of our introduction titled Why Government Can't Be Run Like a Business. There are just too many differences. For example, in business, you get your money from your customers. Right? When you and I go to buy a camera or a radio or a car or whatever it is, we, by our own free choice, decide to buy a product or a service. And the business succeeds by pleasing us, the customers. Government organizations don't get their money from their customers. They get it from a legislature or a city council or a county board, which gets it by taxing the public. In government, people have to run for re-election every 2 years or every 4 years. That gives them a very short time horizon. In government, usually we've got monopolies. In the private sector, usually you've got competition. So there are so many differences that while government can learn a lot of things from business, and in fact, a lot of the public entrepreneurs out there have read Drucker, and they've read Deming, and they've read Peters and Waterman, In Search of Excellence, and a lot of the good management books from the private sector. But you've really also got to think about what government is really like.
So are you talking about taking the post office, taking the schools and privatizing them, making them into businesses?
No, we're not big advocates of privatization. Sometimes private organizations can do a job better than public. Sometimes public organizations can do a job better. Sometimes nonprofit voluntary organizations can do the job best. And government really ought to use the organizations that can do the job best. The key is to have some competition in there, to measure the results and have some competition, because so much of the problem with whether it's the schools or our welfare system or job training or street sweeping, whatever you're talking about, so much of the problem is that we use monopolies. We use public monopolies. And if they don't do a good job, nothing bad happens. I mean, look at education. If you're running a public school and the kids aren't learning, what happens to you? Nothing. No negative consequences. If you're doing a great job and the kids are learning real well and winning prizes and everybody's very pleased, does anything good happen to you? Promotion, pay, rewards, awards? No, nothing good happens. It's a monopoly system, and we need competition to change that sort of thing, but we believe it should be competition within a public system. We don't advocate vouchers for private schools.
So how do you introduce competition into the public system?
Well, you give parents a choice of which public school to send their kids to. You let the schools differentiate. You give the principals and the teachers a lot more authority to change their schools, so that you might have one school that focuses heavily on computers and another school that focuses heavily on performing arts and another school that focuses heavily on health sciences and one school that's an open classroom and another that's very traditional and the kids wear uniforms. I mean, lots of differentiation, so there's real choices out there because all kids learn differently. You know, it's a myth that we can have effective schools by teaching every child the same way. Then you're going to put all the schools under pressure to really please the parents. I'll tell you, I have four children, and I believe very deeply in the value of public education. And the thing that's so frustrating to me, personally, as a consumer of government services, is the public education system. We're running these schools exactly like we ran them 50 years ago. I mean, it's unbelievable when you think about it. Do you know why we don't have choice in most public school systems? Have you ever thought about that? Why parents can't choose? Because when these systems were created, it was 100 years ago, and it was the days of the horse and buggy. And the only practical thing was to assign the child to the closest school. So we've always done it that way. And that's really the only reason.
Of course, some of the kids are still going to be stuck at the worst schools.
Well, right now, some of the kids are stuck at the worst school.
Yeah,
right now, we have a public education, we have an education system in which everybody from sort of the upper half of the middle class and above has choice. Because people who can afford it either move to a town that has good schools or send their kids to private school, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. We all know that.
Right.
Okay, the poor kids are stuck, and particularly in the inner city, they're stuck in terrible schools, and they don't have a choice, and nothing, as I said, when those schools are failing, nothing bad happens to them. No principals are replaced, no teachers are replaced, there are no negative consequences. Now, what would happen if you went to a competitive system? Well, those kids in the inner city schools could begin to move out to other schools, to better schools, and the poor schools would begin to shrink. And what's going to happen? What's a school district, a school board going to do when it loses hundreds and hundreds of kids and a couple of million dollars in revenue because the kids are fleeing lousy schools? It's going to react. Suddenly there's going to be pressure to improve those poor schools. They're going to replace the principal. They're going to replace some of the teachers. They're going to turn the program around. And in fact, the place where this worked first was East Harlem in New York City, in one of the poorest districts in America. They started creating alternative schools in the 70s, and in 1982 they went to a full choice system. It's very competitive. They close down schools that aren't attracting enough kids, and they open them up again with new management, new principals and teachers. And those kids, you know, 15% of the kids could read at grade level when they started this. And by 1988, 64% could. When they started, about 5 junior high graduates a year could get into New York's selective public high schools like Bronx Science and Brooklyn Tech. By 87, 319 kids were getting into those schools, double the citywide average. I mean, it's a dramatic turnaround, and it's because they use choice and they use competition.
My guest is David Osborne, co-author of the new book, Reinventing Government. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, David Osborne, is a journalist and a consultant to state and local governments. You have been consulting to various local governments. You've consulted to political candidates as well. One of the people you've consulted is Bill Clinton. What kind of advice have you given him?
Well, Governor Clinton, I've known him since 1985, and he called me up last August and said, you know, I'm thinking of running, and I know you've been writing about reinventing government. I love some of the articles you've done. I give them to every elected official I meet. And I'd like you to write me a speech on reinventing government because that's going to be one of my basic campaign themes. So I did that, and I sent him the book manuscript at that point. And that's basically what I've done. Every once in a while, the campaign calls with a question, or I send a memo in or something. But my advice has essentially been not so much how to run the campaign, because, you know, he knows how to run a campaign far better than I do. I've simply been providing him with material to help him talk about this issue of fundamentally changing government, particularly at the federal level.
In your vision of how the government should be reformed, where do you see taxes fitting in? Does this depend on raising taxes?
No, not at all. In fact, I mean, I'm a bit of a spender myself, but the American people aren't at this point. I mean, the American people basically in the late 70s said, listen, we're not going to let you spend more than 35% of GNP on government. In 1940, we spent 20% of GNP on government. By 1975, it was 35%. And the American people basically said no more. We've had a tax revolt really ever since. And if you don't believe that, go ask Jim Florio, the governor of New Jersey. So it's really a moot point. We can't spend a whole lot more on government. The people won't let us. The only way we've been able to do it is by borrowing hundreds of billion dollars every year at the federal level. And that's becoming intolerable. So regardless of whether you want higher taxes, lower taxes, more spending, less spending, we are up against the wall in government. We've got to figure out a way to get more for less.
What do you consider one of your successes as a consultant?
I think one of the achievements is that Florida, the state of Florida, has fundamentally reformed its civil service system. Now, that doesn't seem like much to most people, but let me just explain. Civil service is the personnel system in government, in most governments. It's how you hire people. It's how you fire them. It's how you promote them. It's how you pay them. And it's an absolute straitjacket. I mean, it was invented in 1883 in this country. It was invented for a government of clerks. And it tells you, for example, that you have to hire one of the top scorers on a paper and pencil test. And when you promote, you have to give people paper and pencil tests and promote the top scorers, regardless of how people perform on the job. And you can't give people bonuses or any greater pay for greater performance. And when you have a layoff, everybody gets to bump everybody else by seniority. So you end up with the deadwood staying and the new people leaving and everybody in jobs they don't want and they're not trained for and they resent. I mean, Florida has totally reformed its civil service system. And in fact, they experimented by letting a couple of departments free last summer, from both the line item budget system and the personnel system. And it's a wonderful story. In one of them, the Division of Workers' Compensation, which is basically a big insurance firm for people who are injured on the job, has about 500 employees. They do a lot of clerical work. They key punch entry and filling out forms and so on. And you can measure their productivity pretty easily. The guy who runs it, a wonderful man named Frank Scruggs, got rid of 20 middle management positions. He laid off about 10 people and took about 10 positions that were empty and just got rid of those and used the money, because he had the budget flexibility, for performance bonuses for these 500 line employees. If their productivity went up, they could get a monthly bonus check. Well, I mean, the first month, one unit increased its productivity by 50%, and another by 60%, another by 30%. By the end of 3 months, over half of the department, over half of 500 employees were getting monthly performance bonuses, and the department had increased its productivity, the equivalent of hiring 52 new people. I mean, that's dramatic. I mean, such a simple change, and you get this dramatic increase in productivity. And I think, with all humility, I actually had something to do with Florida taking those steps, and that's been very satisfying.
You know, one thing about the civil service system, as arcane and bureaucratic as it is, it was meant to prevent corruption and favoritism, and
exactly,
to ensure fairness and
exactly,
to ensure promotion through skills and talents as opposed to favoritism.
Did a good job of that.
Uh-huh.
It really did a good job of that. And it accomplished that goal in most governments by 1940. There were some exceptions. Chicago just got a civil service system in the 70s. But the problem is, you know, when we did this, there were no public sector unions, and the courts had not laid down 100 years ago any rules, any laws about wrongful discharge and so on. Now we've got these civil service systems. We've got public employee unions, which put in a lot of protections for their members. And we have court decisions that make all patronage illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can always sue for wrongful discharge. There are a lot of protections that the courts have put in. So we got this triple layer of protections. And it's become gridlock. In addition, you know, we're not running a government of clerks anymore. You can't measure somebody's talent by giving them a paper and pencil test anymore for most or for many government jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So what was once a very effective, very necessary personnel system for the 19th century is now a straitjacket and a real obstacle. And we need to develop personnel systems for the 21st century. And that's true across the board. I mean, most of these progressive era reforms were very important in their day, but they were designed for an industrial society. And we're no longer an industrial society. Everything about this society has changed.
Where do you see the impetus for reinventing government coming from? Do you see it coming from the politicians themselves who are elected into office? Do you see it coming from the voters, from outside consultants, from workers? Where does your hope lie?
Well, I tell you, it's changed in the last 2 years. It was coming mostly from public managers until a couple of years ago, people who ran departments or ran cities or the management people. They understood that they really needed new ideas, and they were all out reading Tom Peters and Peter Drucker and Deming and so on. 2 years ago, everything changed because we hit a recession and every government in America was broke. I mean, the fiscal crisis that we have today is mind-boggling. California last year with almost a 25% deficit they had to close. And the problem is this, it's not going to go away. Half the problem is recession, but half of it is spending out of control. So these politicians now are desperate. They're just absolutely desperate for some new ideas about how to get more for less, because they all have to get more for less. And the option is usually getting not reelected, getting thrown out of office. So the impetus now is coming from the politicians. And that gives me great hope, because the politicians are usually the last ones to get it.
Well, David Osborne, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure. I want to thank you.
David Osborne is the co-author of Reinventing Government. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.